Hello, I'm Lina Khmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will discuss the work of international NGOs in improving Africa's health system. But first, the World Health Organization says after more than 2 years of consultations, it has been agreed that all pathogen particles transmitted through the air, regardless of size, should be referred to as infectious respiratory particles or IRPs. The new terminology will apply not just to the COVID virus, but to other respiratory infections such as tuberculosis, influenza, and measles. WHO says broad agreement on the new terminology across the scientific community should improve understanding and make collaboration easier across disciplines. Researchers have identified a new lineage of the mpox virus, formerly known as monkeypox, that is linked to efficient human-to-human transmission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. A group of Canadian and other scientists working in the country began tracking a large mpox outbreak in the country's Kamituga mining region since October and found a new distinct clade IB lineage of the mpox virus, featuring mutations that are a hallmark of efficient transmission between humans, calling it alarming. A new study conducted in 17 sub-Saharan Africa countries between 2019 and 2022 found that bed nets treated with an additional insecticide are between 20% and 50% more effective in preventing malaria than those treated with the standard single pyrethroid insecticide. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria funded the trials as part of the new NETS project. The rollout of the new product will further expand to other countries, according to the organization. Now, in the global healthcare landscape, non-governmental organizations play an important role in reaching communities around the world with medical care, particularly in low- and middle-income countries. From remote villages to urban slums, NGOs deploy resources and expertise to deliver essential services such as vaccinations to prevent infectious diseases and maternal and child health support. But their work and impact are not without challenges. I spoke with Ambassador Daniel Speckhard, President and CEO of Chorus International, to discuss how Chorus International work in Africa to help improve the healthcare system. Take a listen. Ambassador Daniel Speckhard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You just attended the 2024 ACHAP conference in Abuja, Nigeria. What were some of the main takeaways for you?
Well, it was exciting to be there with so many countries represented. You know, what I really took away was how important these faith-based organizations are in providing health care to their populations, particularly the most vulnerable populations. They really work in the areas in these countries that are hard to reach, more of the rural populations, difficult places to get health care. And they are oftentimes providing anywhere between 30 and 70% of the health care in the countries where they're working. So they really need to be integrated more into the national systems for health care. The second thing that we talked a lot about at this conference is how we're falling behind on the United Nations goal that's been set for universal health care coverage by 2030. And I think what we all learned is that to meet that goal, everybody's going to have to contribute, right? It's not just national systems that are going to make that by themselves. And so faith-based organizations involved in healthcare can play a very large role in this.
Collaboration with faith-based NGOs in the health sector is highlighted as a key aspect of Chorus International's strategy. What impact has this collaboration created?
Yeah, well, we've been committed to this for about two decades, long before a lot of the Current international sector recognize the importance of this local connection and partnership. For us, this has been immensely important because we have seen all along that to have a lasting impact, you need to be working through local organizations and local community structures, right? The local faith-based organizations are the ones that have the trust of the communities and can best represent them in finding solutions that are going to be lasting and work. They also become very important advocates within their government systems at the local, regional, and national levels to ensure that the governments are putting resources toward this important problem of health. You know, the reality is governments are losing enormous shares of their potential GDP or income by having unhealthy populations. And they need to be investing, particularly in the youth and the women in their countries, to ensure that they are as productive as they can be and be successful in the international markets.
As Chorus International invests in health on the continent, what are some of the key priorities when it comes to improving the health sector on the continent?
Yeah, well, a key element of that is ensuring that we work more on primary health care. It's still the weak link, right? My primary health care and maternal child health are central to success in these countries, right? Many of them are developing better hospitals in their cities. They have some of the best doctors now trained internationally and locally through better and better schools. So it's not oftentimes the same problem in the cities as it is in these rural areas, and particularly for primary health care for these rural areas. And so to really get better and universal coverage of health care, we're focusing a lot on that. We're also focusing on non-communicable diseases with our faith-based partners, which are a big challenge, and particularly in Africa. Many of these things are preventable, but they take concerted effort. Last thing, we're looking at some things that haven't gotten enough attention in the past, like mental health care, which is really an epidemic in many of these countries, and sexual and gender-based violence, right? The violence that's happening against women in these is often something never talked about and not well recognized and understood at the breadth of that problem. And this has long-term impacts. We know mental health and trauma and violence has long-term impacts on the health of individuals as well as whole communities.
Talk to us about the implementation phase. You mentioned that faith-based organizations are definitely a partner group that you work with. What does it look like when it comes to implementing your model and services on the ground?
Yeah, well, traditionally in the past, it was that there were big donors like USAID or the UN or other European donors, and they needed implementing agents, and they would come to international nonprofits like Chorus International to execute and implement our programs. And we would go and connect with local partners to do the grassroots on the ground delivery of services at the local level. What we're seeing now, though, is that more of the role for the international NGOs is to help build the capacity and to support the local NGOs for them to take much of a more of a lead role in this. The area that we're finding most work still needs to be done and where there's value added from organizations like Chorus International is kind of the systems that need to support and help in this process, as well as the issues related to monitoring and evaluation, finance, compliance, all these big issues required by big donors that require lots of reporting, lots of data, lots of technical aspects to this. The good news is that what's happened over the last several decades is the intellectual capital in African countries has grown tremendously, right? You don't need doctors from international NGOs anymore, except in perhaps humanitarian situations of urgent conflict or crises where you just need a surge. You have the technical expertise, you have the medical expertise, you have the health expertise, but the systems around all those people aren't yet built enough and strong enough to deliver services throughout your countries and to reach the unreachable or the most vulnerable population. So what's happening is there's a big change and dynamic happening now Where on the service delivery side, African organizations like these faith-based organizations are stepping forward, taking that role, and now international nonprofits and donors are moving to a secondary role, trying to manage and ensure that the resources are used well, documented, and ensured that they went for what they were supposed to go for, and the results and the impact are proving the success of the design of those projects.
Prioritizing the development of local capacity is a cornerstone of CORUS International's approach. You mentioned it. How does this strategy contribute to addressing future challenges and leaving a lasting impact in the communities you serve?
Well, what we see is that it's really in their sustainable results, right? In the old model where international NGOs came in and did it themselves, and you had a five-year project, the results were there. You got good results and they lasted for 5 years. Then the international NGO left and there was a rapid decline and the services ended. I've seen this many times in my own travels where I go out on a rural development project and they show me their health clinic. And the health clinic is an empty building that was built by an international NGO through a donor-funded project, but there's no pharmaceuticals, there's no staff, there's no support in that place. That's the old model. The new model says, hey, the communities and the local organizations are part of this. So from the beginning, you design and you ensure that there's a long-term plan for when the international donor is no longer there. How is this clinic going to be supported? How does it fit within the national system? How do they advocate and ensure that they get the resources they need or the pharmaceuticals they need coming to their region? And you build that in from the beginning. And so that local capacity building to ensure they have the tools that this project will last long beyond the five-year term or whatever it was designed by the original donor is what I've seen to be the most successful part of this.
How do you measure impact?
Well, for us, impact at the end of the day is the outcomes that we see in the populations that we're trying to support and serve, right? So you measure it through the number of diseases, the mortality rate of infants, the mortality of mothers giving birth, the number of cases of malaria, the delivery of pharmaceuticals, the number of vaccines being provided, and the impact that's having on reducing disease. So all of those things are really important, but even more important, and it's a little harder to measure, is that capacity building piece that we were talking about. So what we watch in that particular context is to see when and how our local non-government organizations, as well as local governments, ready to step up and be direct recipients of international assistance and be able to deliver those with similar results that the nonprofits produced, right? And that's not always a given, right? Because as I'm sure you know, in many government contexts, including in developed countries, the government resources don't have the same impact as when a local community-based organization delivers it because their overheads are much less and they're able to manage much more closely and directly. So we're watching that piece as well. But there's lots of measures in here. But at the end of the day, you know, for us, let's focus on getting universal health coverage across Africa, that everybody has the ability to access healthcare, and that we're no longer losing children on preventable diseases and that they're dying before the age of five, or mothers are dying in childbirth for no reason, or simple diseases that can be solved through vaccines are no longer becoming an epidemic across particular areas or regions or communities or countries because we were able to get the vaccines there and the medicines to help on recovery.
How does CORUS International adapt its strategies to address evolving global crises and emergencies? COVID-19 was eye-opening for many. There's also climate change that seems to be a growing concern globally.
Yes. Well, CORUS is, I think, somewhat unique in the concept that we really look at these things in a holistic way. Our view is that international development has gotten too siloed, that there are people working on agricultural or development, there's people working on health, there's people working on environment and climate change. But if you're sitting in one of your communities in Africa, you're seeing all of these things at the same time, and it's a complex, interrelated challenge for the families and those communities. So if you don't address them together, you're going to find your results are very limited. And so for us, we're focusing a lot on how we look in a more holistic way. And so bringing together health programs, traditional health programs, with agricultural programs that focus on nutrition, for example, because health can be really improved by having more nutritious diets in the family of these rural communities. And now you're killing two birds with one stone, as we say in English, that you're solving two problems with one approach. Second, we're also very much focused on this continuum between emergencies, recovery, and development, right? In the old days, emergencies, you just brought in trucks and handed out stuff. And then you went away when the emergency was over, but the communities were left with having to solve that problem, which is they had been decimated by that crisis and they didn't have enough to rebuild. Now we need to think more about, instead of bringing trucks with food in, how do you bring bakery equipment in? How do you bring cash resources to start employing people again in these communities? How do you take a more development approach in the middle of a humanitarian crisis to ensure that as you're responding to the crisis, you're actually building capacity in those communities to deal with the recovery long after those international aid agencies or the government, local governments, national or international aid agencies have left?
And Ambassador Speckhard, looking ahead, what are the key priorities and strategies for Couriers International in further advancing its mission of building resilience?
Yeah, I mean, for us looking forward in building resilience, I think the strategy is really going to be, how do we build broader and bigger partnerships? The reality is foreign assistance from governments is not enough globally, and especially in sub-Saharan Africa, for the challenges you are facing, that we need to, just like we did at this conference, be combining all the elements from faith-based organizations to corporate organizations to foundations to international organizations to national governments. And we need to be coming together in a much more holistic way across countries. That's what I loved about this too. They were bringing the faith-based organizations from more than a dozen countries together to solve these problems. If we silo ourselves and just look at one particular African country's problems and don't put it in the context of more, and we don't bring a much larger group of players together, we're not going to have success. So Couriers International wants to be help as a convener, as a connector, and putting these local organizations in touch internationally with the organizations and the answers and the best practices that can help solve their problems.
Any final thoughts before we wrap?
I have to say, my final thoughts is, I know these are difficult times in the world, right? But I am excited by what I saw when I was in Abuja, in Nigeria. You know, is what I started this conversation with. The talent in Africa is outstanding, right? The commitment is there. The passion is there. That people should not get discouraged when they see where we were 30, 40, 50 years ago. The local intellectual capital, Africans helping Africans, the possibilities for the future. At the end of the day, these are solvable problems. But they're going to be solved by smart people, and they're going to be solved by smart Africans. And I'm excited about the prospects for that continent.
Ambassador Daniel Speckhard, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This was Ambassador Daniel Speckhard, President and CEO of Couriers International. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. We'll have more when we return. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This week on Straight Talk Africa, the International Monetary Fund says economic recovery is slow and incomes in sub-Saharan Africa fell further behind the rest of the world. Join me, Vincent McCorry, and my guests for an in-depth discussion on sub-Saharan economics on the next Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, specifically in the Beni and Butembo region, parents are finding it hard to get their children vaccinated. Zanem Neti Zaidi reports.
In the town of Butembo, vaccination programs have come to a stop. The head nurse of the Makasi Health Area, Kambale Wangahikia, confirms the absence of vaccines in certain areas of North Kivu province. He says they are missing several vaccines, such as the one that fights pneumonia and helps children fight coughs, and also the vaccine that fights meningitis and mumps. He says that all children born and unborn are therefore still at risk. This situation creates frustrations for breastfeeding women. One mother, Kasuki, is worried because her infant son has not yet received the BCG vaccine against tuberculosis. She says she has a four-month-old baby, but he's having trouble getting BCG and other vaccines. She went to the hospital four times and couldn't find anything. The doctors gave her several appointments, but when she arrived, she could hardly find anything. She's worried that her baby will catch serious diseases. Another mother, Stephanie, says she made several trips to health facilities to have her children vaccinated. It was only last week, she says, that her son received his first dose of vaccine. She tells us about the fear she felt. She says she felt very bad because the vaccine she had been looking for a long time was very important for her child, because if he didn't get it, he would be exposed to disabilities and diseases when he grew up. She says that the health authorities should force themselves to bring in the vaccines, because this shortage could cause problems for the children later on. Kasuki Defros, a nurse at Beni's University Clinic, says that not vaccinating children has consequences for the physical health of newborns. She says that local authorities are working hard to respond to this shortage. She says that if children aren't vaccinated against polio, for example, they risk becoming weak and their muscles won't be strengthened. She says the authorities intend to respond to the shortage soon. According to officials from the Beni Health Zone, which oversees dozens of hospitals in the region, over 1,000 children are waiting to be vaccinated in several towns in the Beni and Butembo region. Zanem Nchizaidi, VOA News, Goma, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
A lack of clean water in health facilities across seven African countries is causing enormous rates of infections, which are leading to tens of thousands of avoidable deaths, according to the group WaterAid. Catherine Nightingale, who is WaterAid's Global Director of International Affairs, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme she presented data to world leaders, bankers and donors on the impact of infections at health facilities on the continent.
We looked at Ethiopia, Ghana, Mali, Malawi, Nigeria, Zambia, and Uganda. And these are really typical countries. They range, you know, across Africa, but as examples in terms of size, but they're pretty typical of the fact that in a lot of parts, there are not water and sanitation facilities in the health centres that people might be going to when they're sick, when they're going to give birth, when they're going to get vaccinated, when they're going to look after their children or get their children seen to. And what that means is that they can go into these facilities and acquire an infection, and then that can have a knock-on impact. It can mean that they get very sick, it means they're off work, it might mean that they die tragically, and all of that has a huge, not only emotional cost to the people who lose loved ones, but also a huge economic cost if people can't work and they can't bring that income in. So we worked to kind of calculate the cost of those healthcare acquired infections, and in doing so, we were able to show that in the year 2022, there are 2.6 million healthcare-associated infections across those seven countries. Overall, those led to 275,000 deaths. And those numbers are likely to be an underestimate because they only really focus on people who went into hospital. And at WaterAid, we know that water and sanitation and hygiene are one of the main ways you can stop infections happening. So if we can get kind of the measures in place, including really good wash in those facilities, water, sanitation and hygiene, we call it WASH, then we know we can reduce this. And we calculated that we could reduce it by half. And we calculated that actually we could be investing, maybe just $1 per person, per capita in each country, and you'd be able to get that water and sanitation into the health facilities and really, really cut this down by half.
That was your message. You want basically the bankers and financiers who were attending these meetings to say, look, this is so obvious and we can cut the costs in half and save lives in the making if you just give us this money, and then we'll build these water facilities in the hospitals and the health facilities. Right.
We weren't even asking for it for us necessarily. We were saying to the finance ministers in those governments, and in fact, we were very pleased to have with us the Minister of Finance from Malawi, who joined us for our event and talked to us about how useful it is to have data that demonstrates that you can make this investment and you can sort of save money as a result.
This data is being presented not just to the bankers and the big executives and the World Bank and IMF folks. It's going back to the countries in Africa. Their leaders saying, look, just do this. You'll save so much in costs and in lives.
That's right. That's exactly it. We're trying to help give them the tools to make the case inside their governments. And we're, talking to finance ministers, also presenting. It's just really just launched, Carol. So we're really hoping to present it, ongoing in the next few weeks so that these national governments and their ministries of health and ministries of water and sanitation can see just how important this investment is.
Catherine Nightingale, WaterAid's Global Director of International Affairs. Now, the World Food Programme says Zimbabwe is at a peak of its lean season, with 2.7 million people across the country facing food insecurity, even before effects of an ongoing drought kick in. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mangwe, one of the most affected districts.
In southwestern Zimbabwe, crops in the Mangwe area have withered away. Even local farmers will be among Zimbabweans who need aid until next year. That includes 42-year-old Singazi Sibanda, a mother of three children.
All my crops were burned by the sun. I don't know how we will get to next year and where we will be. The crops died at early stages.
Mangwe is one of the districts in Zimbabwe most affected by drought. Local officials say some people may have to go work in nearby Botswana or in urban areas to survive.
Boreholes
have no water. Dams are drying up. There is no grazing grass for animals. Maybe some hay will be brought from other areas to feed the local animals.
Food is being distributed in hard-hit areas. Evelyn Ndlovu is the minister of Matabeleland South, also in the Mangwe area. She says the government is in touch with international aid agencies to get more help. Officials say the crisis is growing worse in the region due to recurring droughts caused by the El Nino weather pattern.
The crop situation in Zimbabwe is very poor at the moment, and we expect that the number of people who will not have adequate stock from their own production to last them until the next harvest, which would be then by the middle of next year, that number of people who will not be able to meet their food needs over that full period will go up.
Zimbabwe's government says the 2024 grain harvest will yield about 868,000 tons of grain, an alarming 62% drop from last year's total.
That's reporter Columbus Mavunga from Mangwe. That's a wrap for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Nabil Biagio. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.